big news on Network 23 tonight is that the next 11 minutes will not be interrupted by commercials. This is Network Chief Ben Cheviot's personal gesture to viewers on Sky Clearance Night.
Run number six, stand by. Terry, pull up the Monback story.
Say that one more time, Control.
I said the automatic sensor tripped in. The show has been pulled.
Automatic sensor? But I'm looking for a kid's mother. How can they pull that?
We don't know, and the only person who can tell us won't.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, sometime before 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. Online only, I'm afraid, still. I'm Tony Gosling, just back from New Zealand. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. We're also joined by leader of the Lib Dem group on Bristol City Council and councillor for Knowle, Gary Hopkins. So I think maybe we should start, Gary, by you giving us your take on the way that you think that, Bristol seems to be one of the cities which is not too badly affected by the virus itself. But what do you think about the measures that have been taken nationally and here to deal with it?
Well, I think some of the measures have been entirely appropriate. Timing has been bad. Initially, the government were very slow in terms of imposing lockdown, and that didn't affect us quite so much in our region because we were a little bit behind, but certainly had a very negative effect on the figures in London. I think now the problem is that it's all very well for us to actually criticise what the government have done or failed to do at the right time previously, but I think we need to look very, very carefully now on what their plan is for getting us out of the situation that we're actually in and some of the other effects. I think one of their successes has been building these special hospitals quickly and equipping them, but it staggers me that we're actually apparently not going to use them unless the things continue to go badly wrong. Now, quite frankly, we have people who are going to be dying in other aspects of the National Health Service, cancer treatment and various other things, because all their services have been closed down. And while we've got these extra hospitals and the extra capacity, it strikes me that one of the urgent things that we must actually do is use them for what they've been prepared for, to free up at least one hospital in each region, so that it can get on with some of the more urgent other work.
Now, Martin, what are your thoughts? I think we'll be listening here to today's statement on Radio 4, or interview with the Health Secretary Matt Hancock, about this whole idea of how we get out of lockdown, because certainly looking around the world, seems that the US and Britain may be the last countries to come out of the lockdown. And that could simply be, I mean, this is just my take on this speculation, because we don't know what we're doing. We are just flying by the seat of our pants, and we can't see an exit strategy for the situation that we've got ourselves into.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, basically, both the US and Britain were very laggardly in taking the thing seriously. And of course, in that case, you're probably going to end up having a longer lockdown than otherwise might be necessary. And that you can't evade that.
Well, I mean, you can.
The state's already made us path dependent.
You can. Well, Bic, you can evade that to a certain extent by pointing to countries like South Korea and Sweden that haven't had anything like this kind of lockdown, but are now looking at, they've basically taken this approach.
Well, South Korea tested everybody from the get-go, and pursued a testing strategy, which we explicitly stopped doing because we didn't believe in it, although now we do believe in it. So we've clearly changed our strategy from a non-testing strategy to a testing strategy.
Yeah.
Gary?
Yeah, the test and trace is absolutely necessary. And if we're going to get out with any out of this situation, then that's got to be ramped up massively. And the government are talking figures at the moment, but the infrastructure that they're putting in to allow for proper testing is not there. They haven't thought through properly the tracing. I mean, apart from anything else, we've got 750,000 people who volunteered to assist the NHS. As far as I can tell, they've been given nothing to do.
Amazing. One of the good bits of news, though, is that we've had fantastic weather for people to get out and sit in their gardens if they've got them. Obviously, if you're living in a tower block, that's not quite so easy. And the good news being that sunshine kills this virus. Now the experiments have been done in 2 minutes. So it must mean that with all this sun, that's actually kind of helping things along, not only just cheering us up, but meaning that the virus is being thwarted. The funny thing is here, Gary, I wonder what you make of this, is that, of course, that means that actually outside is a worse place for the virus than inside when we're hearing that the sunshine kills the thing.
Yeah, I think that rather than banning people from going out, we just need to make certain that when they're out, that there are the better controls. I mean, in Bristol, we've got the situation where our cemeteries are still closed. And quite frankly, those are places where people find quite a lot of peace and are able to walk around without causing any danger to anybody, as long as they're behaving responsibly. And Bristol, I think, is one of the very few councils in the city that are resisting the government calls for the reopening of the cemeteries.
Amazing. I mean, one of the most shocking aspects to all of this is, I mean, I was reading just yesterday that it's quite feasible. If I have problems with my internet in my home, for someone to come and fix that, that's deemed an essential service. They don't have to wear a mask. They can come into my home. And yet, if one of my parents is dying, I'm not allowed to go and visit them. And there just seems to be, actually quite a nasty angle to this, where they're removing the kind of human side. Now, one can understand, say, for example, limiting numbers at a funeral, making sure there's social distancing at a funeral, but not being allowed to go and see a loved one on their deathbed is a pretty extreme measure, I think, Gary.
The irony of it is that the mindset of the general public is more towards cooperating and helping than it has otherwise been. I mean, I've been speaking to a lot of residents, particularly elderly residents, in my ward over the phone. And the overwhelming response coming back is people helping each other, which is great, and also commentary from quite a number of the older people in particular, that they found that people are far more sociable at a 2 metre distance than they ever were before. So, you know, offers to go and do the shopping and all that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, which is very encouraging. So much here, but certainly in New Zealand, what people tend to be doing is going out for walks around their local area on their promenade and taking with them a little sort of fold-up chair, so that when they saw someone they knew, either on the other side of the street or in their garden, they would then sort of sit there on the opposite side of the pavement or the opposite side of the street and have a chat over a few metres distance. And this was almost a completely new way. I'd never really seen any this ever happening before in the UK.
Well, actually, New Zealand is an example of a country who's got it actually right. When the death figures, I think, are about 14. Total, not per minute, as we seem to have in other places. And they acted extremely quickly in terms of lockdown, were very firm about it. And actually, the Prime Minister communicated extremely openly and honestly with people, which I think is a considerable help.
In Sweden, cafes and restaurants have stayed open, and same in South Korea. But we had today the Swedish Prime Minister saying, his country's had a lot of criticism, saying that the death rates in Sweden are quite high, a little bit higher than average. But he's pointing out, he's saying, well, yes, but by allowing young people to catch this and get over it, we have protected the country against a second wave, which is now exactly what we're hearing in the UK. A second and a third wave means that we can't lift the lockdown yet. So what about this whole idea of a second wave and a third wave, Gary?
Well, the point is that as there's a gradual unwinding of the complete lockdown, and there will have to be bits and pieces that are allowed and gradually keeping a monitor on things, we haven't got the testing and tracing in place yet to allow that to happen. And I think that's one of the reasons why the government looks so shambolic at the moment, is because without the testing and tracing, you cannot properly relax the lockdown that we've actually got, because they won't know if it's got back out of control again. They won't know how it's been transmitted.
Yeah, I mean, it's not very good, is it, to have basically filling up wards and overwhelmed hospitals as your only indication as to where you are with the virus. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, speaking on BBC Radio 4 this morning, where he actually, I think you'd agree with me, he sounds a little bit hesitant almost all the way through, as if he's nervous about asking questions. He's actually quite hostile to the interviewer. And he feels almost like he's kind of on the back foot. That's my take of it. But anyway, have a listen to it and see what you think.
There will be an increase in cases of coronavirus. The minute people start moving around more, there will be a number of new infections. The question is only how great that peak might be.
No, I don't think that's right. So this all depends on what's called on the R, the reproductive rate of the virus, how many people on average somebody who has it passes it on to. And we've got to keep that reproductive rate below one, because that means that the virus is in abeyance and the number of new cases is falling. There is evidence that it's somewhat below one, which means that you can make, which means that there may become a point where you can safely make changes, but we're being very, very cautious about that, because if that reproductive rate goes above one and there's too much of a new transmission because of any changes, then of course you're back precisely, as you say, into the potential of a second spike, and that would be a not only obviously bad for health, but it would also be terrible for the economy.
I mean, that's really why I asked about how large any second peak might be, because isn't there a degree of community transmission that can be handled safely by the NHS and indeed might well be needed to see if the vaccine that's currently being trialled can work?
Well, no, I don't think that saying that we should let the virus rip in order to test the vaccine is an approach that anybody would recommend. But the truth is, we need to get the number of new cases right down, and then you can use test, track, and trace to hold it down.
Tell me what right down. Tell me what right down is. Otherwise,
yeah,
it's difficult for anyone to understand.
Well, and the answer to that is that until we know the results of the ONS test I was talking about a minute ago, where we know exactly how many people in the community have had it and currently have got it, we won't know the answer to how low we need to go with the current social distancing measures. So that is one of those scientific unknowns, but we should have the result of that soon in order to be able to make the decisions on the timetable that you that we've set out.
You are
so it's you know, these are, it is, I wish there was more that was known about this. What we do know though is that the curve has been flattened. So the rate of, you know, the number of new cases is no longer going up, which is great. And we do know that the NHS has not been overwhelmed. And they were my two primary objectives right
indeed
at the start
and
of this.
That is why you are facing these repeated calls from different quarters for greater transparency about the next phase. We've heard one from Labour this morning on the programme and one from Gus O'Donnell, the former cabinet secretary, yesterday from senior figures within your own party. Is there a problem with doing what Nicola Sturgeon has done, which is release a framework for easing the lockdown?
Yes, well, we have released a framework. We released it last Thursday, which is five tests for the things that need to happen before we can make changes.
Yeah, you know that's different. We know about your five tests. But
it's not different.
Know,
it's not different, because if you read the Scottish document, it is essentially a reiteration, broadly, of those five tests.
About how to get back to a semblance of normality. It talks about how schools might reopen, about how businesses might operate, whereas what you've done is released preconditions. There is a difference.
It doesn't set out what the Scottish Government is going to do.
No, it's a framework. I just wonder if you think that there is a problem with doing that. Is that why you haven't done the same thing?
I don't have a problem in principle, but what I would say is that it is too soon to make the changes. And it's when, the British public have been unbelievably resolute in supporting the lockdown measures, because they understand the impact on, ultimately, on the number of people who die from this disease. And I stand with the British public in that resolve. And of course, there will be a time when we need to make changes. And that's absolutely right and appropriate.
And would that have to
but
be...
We've set out the five tests to give people the guide to when those sorts of changes can safely be done. Because what I can tell you, Michelle, I will not allow for changes to be made that are unsafe. We've got to keep the public safe. And I understand the economic pressures, but that is my background.
But the data is different for different parts of the UK. I just want to ask you whether there might be a divergence in terms of when different parts of the UK come out of this. Arlene Foster, who will be speaking to shortly on the programme, has suggested that Northern Ireland could come out of lockdown at a faster pace than the rest of the UK. They have lower number of cases, they've had fewer deaths.
Well, I'll address that in a moment, but first I'm going to finish the answer I was giving before you interrupted me. The point is that the improvement in people's in health from getting the number of new cases down and getting it right down is also the best thing for the economy, because the worst thing for the economy would be a second spike. And instead, if you get the number of new cases right down, then you can hold it down through testing, tracking and tracing. And that allows you to release more of the measures. So, I understand those voices who are saying that we should move sooner, but that is not something we're going to do. We are going to move when it is safe to do so. On the second question that you then asked about different parts of the country, many parts of these questions are devolved. And it's true that the incidence, the number of cases as a proportion of the population is different in different parts of the country. London, it's higher. Wales, the southwest of England, Scotland and Northern Ireland, it's lower. But the shape of the curve has been basically the same throughout. So we'll talk to our counterparts, as we always do in the devolved nations. So far, we have moved as one United Kingdom, and I think that's been a very good thing.
And is that the way it should continue, do you think?
Well, it's my preference is that we work together as one country. I think that's where the public's been during this. But I also respect the responsibilities that my devolved colleagues have got. Okay.
Well, that's Matt Hancock, the Health Secretary, there speaking on BBC Radio 4's Today programme earlier today. We've also heard from the FT, though, that this is obviously people trying to represent some of the financial interests hit so hard by the lockdowns, that coming out of lockdown is not as if it's either or. You can do that and you can do it safely, they're saying. Also, the Bank of England governor, new Bank of England governor, has just come out saying a false start from a lockdown, that's what he calls it, would hit confidence. The governor of the Bank of England's warned of a bigger hit to the economy from a premature end to the UK's coronavirus lockdown, saying it would damage people's confidence very severely. So I wonder what Mark Martin, maybe you could start on this, what you make of what you've just heard there, and also this statement from the Bank of England governor saying we must stay in lockdown to help the economy, which seems to be, a bit counterintuitive.
Well, it's not. It's not, because if you have a premature lockdown and then you get a second spike coming through and you have to go back into lockdown, that's likely to have a more devastating effect on the economy than getting it right the first time and then coming out of a lockdown because you've got it right the first time. Coming back to what we were saying earlier, we've got a specific problem here, which is we got it wrong at the beginning of the crisis, drastically wrong. We were going in the wrong direction for quite a while. So it's quite likely that Britain is going to actually come out of lockdown last as compared to countries like New Zealand or South Korea. But can I make just another point quickly, which is we don't know a lot about this virus. It clearly doesn't function like flu. It's not a flu virus. And it's quite clear that some people get reinfected, that there's long-term implications of people who've got it, so that they're having long-term lung problems. All of these things are being discovered as we find out what this damn thing is. And I don't think you can actually say, well, if we could come out of a lockdown and it's quite straightforward. It's not straightforward. It may be that you can't come out of lockdown at all. Now, I'm not saying that. I'm not a medical person, but that's what some medical people are saying. And I think we really need to people who know, listen to people who have got the relevant skills, not just make it up as we go along.
The Mirror is saying that over 70s may have to have a year-long lockdown. Gary, what do you make of what you just heard from Matt Hancock and also this statement from the Bank of England governor?
Well, I suspect that one of the reasons that why Hancock sounds rattled is that he feels he's trying to do the right thing, but there are various lobbies within government, within the cabinet. Don't forget, at the beginning of this, that there was going to be, oh, we'll go for herd immunity. And then they realised 500,000 people would have been killed by that approach and switched tack. But basically, there are still people in government who would choose the economy recovering and accepting higher death rates. And also, of course, we've got to take into account that it's not the economy or health. I think Martin's actually quite right, because if you actually do it bodged up, then the public belief in following government instructions will disappear, and that we could end up with a degree of chaos and people not following sensible instructions. But let's not forget, I was listening to a cancer specialist the other day who said that if we had the lockdown in its present form for a significant period of time, the number of deaths, avoidable deaths because of cancer, could be higher than that from COVID. And that's why I think that we need to look at how the health service is responding and use the extra facilities that we've actually have been built to actually try and allow the health service to resume some of the activities that it was doing before.
Well, this is a very important point, isn't it? I mean, we've seen this week death rates are up, but the only roughly a third of the extra deaths has been due to this COVID-19. Admissions from children's hospitals, we heard just yesterday, is enormously down. Now, I wonder whether this is, I mean, quite what is behind these statistics. Certainly there is appeals from health service officials saying, please do come to hospital if you're ill, come to the accident and emergency if necessary. But are people just nervous about going to hospital now if they think that they...
So some of them are. I mean,
sorry,
I think in some cases...
I mean, the thing is that the nervousness may come from the fact that if someone is admitted to hospital, you may never see them again.
Quite. I mean, in some cases, the A&E figures being down are good news, because some of them were a bit, should we say, some of them were unnecessary visits. On the other hand, I've got a friend who had quite a significant kidney infection and thankfully recovered. But it looked rather dangerous for a while. And they chose not to go to hospital because the number of infections that have happened in some hospitals of COVID, and they wanted to keep clear.
There's also
and there are lots of other people who should be getting treatment and screening for various things that are just not getting it. And that's quite a worry. But I think that because of the extra capacity that's built in, we could do both, because you know, the health service has not been overwhelmed. We have new facilities that especially are targeted at COVID. Let's use them.
Well, we certainly should be. The problem here seems to be that people who have basically had their regular treatments cancelled, I myself have got some minor illness, and, you know, it's certainly no skin off my nose to put off the next visit to the specialist for a few months. That's fine by me. But there's a lot of other people who have more serious conditions. One of my neighbours has got quite a severe chronic respiratory problem that he's now very concerned that's not being treated. So it almost seems as if the health service is geared up for this massive number of people to be admitted with the COVID-19 virus, which hasn't actually happened, and a lot of other treatment has been sidelined as a result. Gary, what do you think, that's fair?
Well, no, but the thing is that what the government will react to is what's in the media, and it's very easy, or comparatively easy, to say this person died because of COVID. is not entirely clear in every case. And there are numbers there, and there are numbers coming out every day. Whereas the person who dies in a year and a half's time because they didn't get the proper screening and treatment on cancer, they're not in the headlines now. But we need to be taking full account of all those circumstances.
Now, I mean, we also heard from Matt Hancock a little bit about this whole idea of, I think it actually might have been the interviewer, about this whole idea of getting reinfected. And now there is a problem here, isn't there? Because we're being told that, you know, we've got to wait for the vaccine, then the lockdown can finish. Although that, I mean, it certainly seems to be one of the things we're hearing. We've also had the first human trials at Oxford University yesterday of some new vaccine that they're testing. It may work, it may not. But we're also being told, Martin, we're being told that the virus can reinfect. So surely what we're doing is a kind of shooting at the moon here. We're really hoping that this vaccine will be effective with the knowledge that this virus can reinfect people. So a vaccine is unlikely to be all that much use.
Well, we haven't got a vaccine for the common cold, and we haven't got a vaccine for HIV/AIDS, despite all the money that's been thrown at it. So you've got to consider the possibility that a vaccine is a red herring. Now, I'm not saying it is or it isn't. I don't know enough to make that call. But you can't presume that this disease, whatever it is going to behave in a predictable fashion. It may reinfect people. It may be, for example, that if you've had it and you haven't even noticed, this is one of the problems with it. People have been spreading who are asymptomatic, which is what makes it so difficult. I mean, with flu, like the Spanish flu in 1918, once people started sneezing and coughing, you knew they were infected and you could isolate them. With this, people wander around, quite a lot of people, we're not sure, wandering around who are basically spreading it, but they don't know they're spreading it. Now, that makes it very difficult to manage it. Now, I don't think we're going to do ourselves any favours by presuming we know more than we actually do about what this thing is. They're still finding out. We've got to basically keep our options open. And as we find out what the real nature of this disease is, we can then take the appropriate action. And it doesn't make sense to me to make hard and fast rules about what you're going to do. Once we've got people infected, then we can end the lockdown. Not if they're still infecting other people.
Also, I mean, I could just give you some comparisons, I suppose, between going to the supermarket here in Britain and doing it in New Zealand. New Zealand was very much better organised. You had hand sanitation. All the trolleys were sanitised over there. When you pick up a trolley and take it into the supermarket, it's been sprayed with the sanitiser. You had a member of staff just to make sure you did that properly. And also sanitation on the way out. The other thing is that the queues in the supermarket were all supervised by staff just to keep an eye on everyone in the queues, just to make sure that people weren't getting too close to each other. There were these big screens up in front of the checkout people so that you basically, what you do is you put your goods on the counter, you then move away, then the checkout person will then come over, check your stuff through. Once it's all checked out, she or he will then move away. You then come in and pay for it and box it up and leave. So it was all very, pretty well organized. The queues outside also supervised. Over here, what I've seen is a very unsupervised. So these measures are there, but everyone is just left to do them. And of course, that is a problem. One of the queues I was in this week, was a mentally ill person who was just kind of wandering around and even bumping into people. So, you know, basically rambling, ranting. So there was no real supervision. Although there was somebody there, there was nothing they could actually do to stop this person being disruptive. And of course, in the city centre, we've got quite a lot of damaged people, who are having to now live in hotels. And they are queuing up just along with everyone else, but without the kind of supervision. So New Zealand, very organised. I would suggest here, Gary, a bit shambolic.
Yes, I'd have to agree, unfortunately, in lots of cases. I get regular updates from New Zealand. I've got relatives there. And although they have, there was a 4 degrees of lockdown, and they're lifting only the first one, which takes them almost actually to the theoretical place that UK is actually in. But as you say, better organised, better controlled.
Yeah, so they have a system of basically level 1, 2, 3 and 4. And when the lockdown started, they had one day of level three, and they're going to be coming out of level four back to level three next Monday. From what we hear from Matt Hancock, Martin, there's no real plan to actually come out of lockdown at all here. What we're hearing is that there are these five tests, and once we've met all these five tests, then the government will start continuing releasing us from the lockdown. But it's a completely different system, a completely different process, and it does seem as if there's an attempt here, both here and in the US, to keep these lockdowns going until the government actually sorts itself out, gets its act together, and decides what it's planning to do. There are some plans out there. Like there's a traffic light plan saying that that we will be on red traffic light until the 11th of May, when hairdressers and garden centres can open. Amber on the which will go amber on the 25th of May, where businesses of some types can open, restaurants and schools can open with social distancing rules in place. And then green on the 15th of June, where pubs can start to open, cinemas, sport and gyms with social distancing rules. But this is just one plan, and it doesn't certainly look as if the government is really taking this up or taking it very seriously. We could be headed for certainly at least, you know, until the end of the year without any real explanation or kind of – it's almost as if Matt Hancock and his friends – don't see it's necessary to tell us when we're coming out and how we're coming out.
Well, that's because they don't know, Tony. The fact is that they've been absolutely incompetent from the get-go. And when there's going to be a public inquiry into all of this, as there was into the Iraq war, and there's plenty, the charge sheet is looking pretty bad already. Now, that because they've made such a cock-up of the initial phases of this crisis, they're now desperate not to do anything which looks smacks of desperation, which could then lead to even further recrimination further down the line.
There's a sort of binary thinking going on here, isn't there? That you've either got to lock down or not lock down, and one or the other, and they don't dare to not lock down because the disease will spread. Well, the Swedes and other countries have proven that that's not necessary. You can have some more at risk.
I dispute that, Tony.
Martin, at risk people in the population staying on lockdown, while people who are much less at risk, say 0.01%, that they might actually be even hospitalised if they catch this, that those sorts of people can be released from the lockdown. But anyway, so you were disagreeing, Martin.
Well, I think if you look at what the situation is in Sweden, I think it's quite useful that different countries have pursued different strategies. Because in case you can actually then compare and contrast. Now, if you compare and contrast Sweden to Finland and Norway, they've had a much worse outbreak than those two neighbouring countries. Also, as Lofgren has said, is the Swedish Prime Minister, they've closed all major sporting events, any meetings of over 50 people and so on. So they're having a lockdown. It's just not as severe. People can go to restaurants, but they have to do table service. No going to the bar in pubs and so on. So in other words, it's a different kind of lockdown. But he's made it clear that they will have to carry on with that lockdown longer because it's not so severe. So
well,
there's a trade-off there.
Ours is open-ended, our lockdown at the moment.
Well, it's open-ended because we messed up the first phases of the crisis with Boris Johnson having a two-week holiday at Chequers, missing five Cobra meetings, and also his famous speech where he said, we're going to take it on the chin and go for herd immunity, which has been completely discredited. So we wasted weeks
and that's why
our lockdown is going to have to go on and on and on. Bad news for the Conservative government.
Some countries, Martin, have been very successful going for herd immunity, actually.
Well, I think this is going to be – it looks like Britain and the US have behaved rather – have got a very bad record in all of this.
And it's worth saying also –
Britain and the US don't believe in government intervention, and their instincts were to just try and bluff it out. They've failed on both counts.
I heard on the news today this whole thing about Donald Trump supposedly saying that he thinks people should be injected with disinfectant. I mean, if you actually listen to what he said, he didn't say that at all. There's a bit of fake news around. I think
I did listen to what Trump actually said. I mean, he's quite frankly clinically mad.
Well, he doesn't. He's not a doctor. He doesn't know the stuff, does he? Obviously.
Well, exactly. But why is he saying it then?
He didn't say that people should be injected with disinfectant. That's just a misrepresentation by the news media.
Well, he didn't say it as such. But he said, "I don't really know about this. But what about this as an idea?" Which I don't think is a terribly constructive contribution.
He was talking about other treatments being available rather than just a vaccine. But anyway, Gary, what are your thoughts then about this whole idea of the lockdown being extended forever? At the moment, it's what it seems like. And there's some alternatives around, the red and amber green idea I just talked about, and possibly over 70s having a longer lockdown, and vulnerable people, say those with asthma, diabetes, things like that, having a different regime.
But I have rather more confidence than Martin in us actually getting a vaccine. I'm pretty certain that one will be produced, something that's effective, but it will take probably a year. So we've got to work out a path between now and then. It's very difficult to work out a path if you don't know what the heck the figures are and what's actually happening out there, which is the position that Britain is in at the moment. I think the only thing that we can be grateful for is that we don't have Trump as president actually undermining sensible measures that have been taken in a number of states and encouraging rednecks into mass protests on the street. I mean, you just really could not believe that a president would actually do that. And that's possibly one of the good things that might actually come out of this, that this is hopefully the final nail in the coffin for Trump. But we'll see what actually happens in this country. But I do believe that we will have a vaccine. But it is true that people can get reinfected from this virus, and our natural immune system seems to act in a very, very strange way and in a very varied way towards it. But that does not mean that we cannot get a virus that will, a vaccine that will be effective. And I believe that we will have. And we've got to work out the path between now, where we are now, and hopefully that position in a year's time. And it will be varied. Just lockdown or not lockdown doesn't explain it. There are different measures that you can actually take to control things. But all of them are dependent upon knowledge, testing and tracing.
Absolutely right. I mean, that's one thing we don't really seem to have got right yet. Anyway, there is another aspect to all of this, and that is the enormous amount of money that the central government has borrowed in order to apparently help pay people that aren't being paid. But much of that money seems to be going to basically just try and prop up the stock market. The figure at the moment is £225 billion has been borrowed. The normal amount annually is around about £800 billion the government borrows. So this is whatever 25% extra this year that they've borrowed just within the last couple of weeks. The annual national debt has been going up and up, and it now looks, because of this extra borrowing, there will be topping £2 trillion. This year. Remember, it was only around about $400 billion in 2008 before the 2008 bailouts and the financial crisis then. And that means we're going up and up and up. And the amount that we're actually paying, the government is paying every year in debt interest, is going up. It's now around about £15 billion annually of our taxes and government revenue. It's just going to pay off the national debt, and it's going up, Martin, $2 trillion in the next few, certainly within the next couple of months. It looks like we'll hit that $2 trillion barrier and go up and up. And now, does it actually matter that national debt is soaring in this way?
In the long run, it does. But in the short run, if you've got a fire, you've got to put it out. And in normal times, if you have a recession, the fact that tax receipts go down and benefits go up is a cushion for the economy. What we should have had in place after the crisis in 2008 is a universal basic income. And a cross-section of MPs have called for that in the last couple of days, including Lib Dems, Labour, SNP, Plaid Cymru and Greens. And if we'd had that in place, then we would have been well positioned to deal with this crisis. But of course, in actual fact, we spent 12 years since 2008 pretending that the banks were fine and that the bailout had worked, And of course, that's just wrong. The banking system was already collapsing last September when this all started to come to fruition. And the Federal Reserve in the US was already pumping money into the repo market because the banks were insolvent. And they've been insolvent for 12 years. And that's what should have been dealt with and hasn't been dealt with for various reasons in different countries. But basically everybody's kidded themselves that was all fixed. And of course it wasn't.
Gary, £225 billion the government's borrowed to try and deal with this. I mean, it certainly looks as if that might only be the first tranche of money that they need to borrow in order to try and keep the national economy afloat.
It's obviously of concern, but I agree with Martin that, you know, when there's a fire, you've got to try and put it out. The thing that really worries me, without proper planning on the health side of it, which we don't have at the moment, without thoroughness on that side, the period of time in which we're going to have to subsidise things is going to be lengthened. And we really need to be in a position where, as we gradually emerge from the position that we've actually got now, the more of the businesses that were viable before can actually revive and get going again. I think the problem is that the government are supporting some businesses, which I think we all know in several months' time in a different environment are not going to be there for the long term. It's fine if you're supporting people's wages to reactivate them again in a number of months' time. But if you're supporting structures which are going to die in the long term, that is a waste of money.
10 billionaires have gained $51 billion this week. This is in Forbes, on the Forbes website, as markets edged up from the stock market crash. Well, I don't think it was quite a crash. That's over-egging it a little bit. This is Jeff Bezos, the world's richest person, logged the second biggest increase. He gained $6.8 billion, bringing his net worth to $124.7 billion. There is a whole list here, Martin. I'll put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Luxury goods tycoon Bernard Arnault's net worth jumped by $6.3 billion up to $92 billion as shares of his LVMH company increased by nearly 7%. It sounds to me as if some people are making an absolute killing out of these government loans and bailouts, Martin. This money is never going to trickle down to the ordinary folk like you and I.
No, it's not. And I think what's happened in the US is very significant because the Federal Reserve has basically taken powers which it never used to have to bail out secretly. There's no clause that allows anybody to know who's being bailed out and on what basis, similar to what happened under the TARP regime in 2008. And they've subcontracted the actual working of this bailout to BlackRock, who are the biggest vulture hedge fund on Wall Street. And they are deciding who gets bailed out, but nobody's allowed to know who's being bailed out. That's probably because the Federal Reserve, as Adam Tooze, the political economist and historian, has pointed out, they're not just bailing out inside the US. The Federal Reserve is effectively becoming the central bank for the world. So they're bailing out certain countries, certain firms are being bailed out. Others are going to be thrown to the dogs. But we're not to know who or on what basis those decisions are being made. This is basically a power grab by the financial elite.
Well, they're not the only ones.
Going to have to be dealt with further down the line.
Well, there's another article I'll put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And that is in the New York Post, over 43,000 US millionaires will get a stimulus averaging $1.6 million each. The Coronavirus Aid Relief and Economic Security Act trumpeted its assistance for working families and small businesses. but it apparently contains an even bigger benefit for wealthy business owners. The committee found the Act allows pass-through businesses, ones taxed under individual income, rather than corporate income, an unlimited amount of deductions against their non-business income, such as capital gains. The Washington Post has said they can also use losses to avoid paying taxes in other years. That gives the roughly 43,000 individual tax filers who make at least $1 million a year a savings of $70.3 billion, or about $1.6 million apiece. So there's a massive amount of tax breaks being given to these 43,000 American millionaires as well, Gary. It does rather make you wonder if some people are just cashing in on this pandemic.
Well, a lot of people got very rich during the Second World War, didn't they? The vast majority of people didn't. And I think, to be fair, the effort from the government in this country has attempted to go in the right direction, even though they haven't got a lot of the details right, given that things should have been done a few years ago and they weren't. And their response has attempted to go in the right direction. But clearly, when you look at the United States and Trump, there's not even a pretense there. And I just hope that people are stupid enough not to notice.
Let's look at some other news this week, because I think it's very important to point out some things which would probably have made major headlines if it wasn't for the virus swamping all the news coverage and the bulletins. Survivors, victims say any chance to learn about the arena bombing in Manchester will be limited after they're refused special legal status. A total of 56 people who survived the atrocity applied for core participant status, an inquiry into the attack, but have been refused this week. I mean, this is pretty shocking, Martin. I think I'll probably ask you to comment on this one first, really, because, I mean, as we know, there are all sorts of problems with the security services being warned several times about specific individuals that went on to then allegedly carry out this attack. The arena bomb survivors have been refused core participant status for the upcoming inquiry. But the chairman of the inquiry insists their voice will be heard. Well, the actual people themselves say they've got a lot of serious questions they want answering about MI5's involvement with not protecting people against someone who they've been repeatedly informed was potentially dangerous. Anyway, so they're not allowed to have a legal representation at this inquiry at all, the actual survivors who were there on the day.
Well, that's because there's an intimate relationship between the British intelligence services and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who are the terrorist organisation behind the bombing, because they've been working with them for years, going back to the 1980s, to overthrow Gaddafi. And the father of the bomber, the named bomber, was working directly with MI6, because he was in the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. At the very least, the links between the British intelligence services and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group would be embarrassing, and it could even be devastating. Incidentally, in the United States, a court in the United States has prevented victims of the 9/11 attacks from suing the Saudi government, and they wanted to release various documents which implicated the Saudi government. The courts in the US have said it was against the national security of the United States to release the documents, and that's because the documents probably show that the Saudi government was complicit, and possibly elements within the US government are therefore implicated. These things are still going on out there. And as you well know, there's lots of rows and arguments flying about what this virus actually is, which probably we will discuss later in the programme.
I mean, the legal side, Gary, basically what this means is that core participants, if they're not going to be allowed to do this, all these things these 56 victims are not going to be allowed to do are... they won't be able to receive any advance disclosure of evidence. They won't, or their lawyers won't. They won't be allowed to make statements or apply through lawyers to ask questions of any witnesses. It does sound as if the survivors of the attack themselves have been almost completely shut out of this the inquiry by Mr. Justice Saunders.
Well, whenever you get any kind of serious emergency, some other people regard it as a good opportunity to... very bad news, don't they? And I think that on a general principle, if people are stopping inquiries, stopping information, there's something to hide.
Well, that's one of the, on that theme, there's been a kind of difficulty for councillors like you, our elected representatives, getting information out of Bristol City Council. In fact, certainly over the last two or three years, less and less is trickling through. Questions get left unanswered, ignored, that sort of thing. I wonder what you make of the whole Bristol Energy debacle. This is a company which I believe it's in the 30s of millions of pounds of our council tax money has been going into this business, and yet it's still to return a profit. Do you think that it's time to pull the plug, or should we just persist with Bristol Energy, Gary, until some money comes in from them?
Well, I, along with other opposition councillors, called a special meeting of council about a month ago, which we had to postpone because of the virus onset. That meeting was not cancelled, it was postponed, and we intend to reactivate that meeting in the near future. And we must make certain that the public are aware of what's happened to their money and what the real prospects or none of any of that money being recouped. And it's absolutely essential that the public know what's actually going on with this, because these are vast amounts of money.
Now, look, I mean, you are not always given the information that you request from the mayor's office and from City Hall generally, Gary. But what do you know about the financial position of Bristol Energy and whether it's actually a viable business or not?
Well, I think that the people can work it out for themselves. That it was originally going to be producing dividends for the council within a few years, and basically the amount of money that's been put into the company, which is publicly known, has gone up and up and up over a period of time. We have no indications of any possibility of it turning round.
And I know that figure is over £30 million now that's been put into this business with no return. Martin, I mean, we were hearing, weren't we, a couple of months ago from Tim Kent, the Lib Dem councillor, that he doesn't believe that it's a viable business at all because the energy market has become so competitive that Bristol Energy simply can't compete. It can't win new customers because it can't provide energy at any lower price than the existing big guys in this field, and they're basically minnows trying to fight a losing battle.
I think that's right. I mean, I don't know the detail, but it seems to me conceptually wrong to imagine that you are going to compete with the oligopoly of the main energy companies. It's just, it's kind of carrying free market dogma to with a kind of sort of socialist tint on it. It's a not-for-profit company. It's a not-for-profit company quite literally because it doesn't make any profit. And of course, what you really need to do, as an old socialist, I have to say this, is you need to nationalise the energy companies, and then you've got, then you're talking. But trying to compete with them by setting up your own version is wrong-headed in principle.
Well, the bizarre thing was, we actually, in the Dem administration in 2010, were looking at an energy company, but something completely different to what the previous mayor actually launched 5 years later. At the time in 2010, we had things called feed-in tariffs, where basically one of the major concepts was slapping up photovoltaic cells on the roofs of council houses, selling cheap electricity to the tenants and actually making a profit, which was guaranteed for quite a number of years ahead, by feeding that into the national grid. Unfortunately, by the time that the mayor actually, previous mayor got round to launching an energy company, it was completely different. And he decided on this marketing organization, no local generation or micro generation at all. No real proper commitment to green energy, which, you know, what local people were quite happy to back. So it was a completely different beast altogether. And unfortunately, I think about 11 million had actually been lost by the time that the present mayor took over. He didn't pay the slightest bit of attention to what was actually going on and just kept on shoveling money in. And of course was hoping that the election would intervene. And before the shit finally hit the fan in a very, very large way, that he would have been re-elected. But all that's now going to have to come out because you can't keep on shoveling money in.
The mayor, Marvin Reeves, The present mayor, Marvin Rees, has made a statement this week about Bristol Energy. He says that setting up Bristol Energy was not sensible, quote. But he says
in his present form, he's right. That was set up by the previous mayor. But of course, it had only been doing about a year when he took it over. So he is three quarters responsible for the huge mess that's there. The previous mayor, Ackley, did set it up completely and absolutely wrongly. And one of the things that we will actually be exposing is the model that was originally suggested back in 2010 and how that completely changed into this bizarre and lunatic marketing organisation which the previous mayor set up with no possibility of it ever actually succeeding in the marketplace as it is, and the present mayor gaily took on and continued shoveling money into it.
I mean, we started here by talking about secrecy, and the article goes on to say that the council's cabinet last month agreed behind closed doors to bring forward an unspecified amount of additional investment. They call it investment. I would call it throwing good money after bad. Earmarked for further down the road, taking it closer to the £37.7 million ceiling the local authority set for the total amount of money it will pump into the firm. But it's not known how close the local authority is to that limit or whether it's now reached it, because the agenda item was exempt from press and public as it contained commercially sensitive information, Gary.
Well, quite. And basically, I'm toddling off to the council's independent auditors. You remember I had to do this before when there was a misdescription of the dodgy payments that were given to the ex-chief executive, Anna Klonowski, where they said that she was entitled to the money and wasn't. That was in the accounts. And the independent auditors refused to sign off the company's accounts until that was actually changed. Now, I believe we have a misdescription here, because calling this an investment when it's absolutely clear to everybody that this is not an investment at all, and there's no prospect of actually becoming a profitable and viable organisation, that is a misdescription in the accounts, and that's why I'm going to the auditors.
Well, glad to hear it. I mean, it just seems to me incredible that it'd be lovely to have the Mayor Marvin Rees on here to explain why he hasn't yet pulled the plug on this. What do you think might be his answer? I mean, he's saying in this article that the energy company wasn't sensible, but we need to be responsible, and he's continuing to fund it.
Well, what he was actually doing was shoveling in the money until after the election, because at the moment it doesn't actually appear on the council's accounts as a loss. It is a loss in reality, but it doesn't show in the council's accounts as a loss. And basically his plan was to get past the election, which had just been cancelled, and then crystallise the losses and say, oh, it's all finished with now. He can't actually do that now, because he is going to have all this come out. You cannot just, especially when the council's going to be under even more financial pressure, you cannot keep on shovelling £1 million a month and more into a company that has no prospects of ever making a profit.
Well, at the moment, Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees is the elected Mayor of Bristol, but as of a couple of weeks' time, he won't be. What do you make of the cancelling of the elections, Gary? I mean, Bristol is going to move from a democratic city into a non-democratic city in May.
I don't think it is a democratic city at the moment. I think that the mayoral system effectively stopped proper democracy several years ago. I think, unfortunately, the government didn't have much choice but to cancel the elections. It's very regrettable.
Well, I think given the pressure that they're actually under. Because in France, they've just had elections in Paris. In France, they've just had local elections there.
Well, possibly. But I don't think it would have been sensible to try to hold the elections in Bristol, as an example, this year, certainly even less so in places like London. The last thing you actually need when you've got a pandemic running on is unnecessary activity. And I agree that it's regrettable, but I don't think the government had a choice.
But I mean, this election for May would have been quite a lot of the people, you know, and discussions around it would have been about whether we wanted an elected mayor or not. I mean, that certainly would have been on the tongues of many of the candidates. Are we going to have an elected mayor in the future? Now that decision, I suppose, is put off, not only the mayor decision, and that decision itself is put off for another year. But the other thing which strikes me as a bit strange about the 1 year delay is, of course, that is going to put us back into potentially another flu season. Rather than the government recommended it to be 6 months so that it would be in the autumn, no, they're saying, no, we're going to be doing this in another year's time.
Well, I don't think we'll be out of this crisis in 6 months' time. So I think the, a year was inevitable. And, you know, as I say, regrettable, but I don't think the government had much other choice, really, in terms of acting responsibly. And yes, I know 2/3 of the people that we've asked in Bristol said they would vote for getting rid of the position of mayor. I think they'll vote for that in exactly the same percentages in a year's time.
If we have another election, because of course everything is sort of up for grabs at the moment. Anyway, let's have a listen now to the mayor himself. He was speaking on BCFM earlier this week, and here is he discusses and in the context of the anniversary of the murder of Stephen Lawrence in London, the racist murder. He discusses the implications of journalism to the cover-up of that murder, the failure really to investigate it properly, and of course the racist press that he thinks encourages these sorts of attacks in the first place. So let's have a listen to that, and it's the Mayor Marvin Rees speaking to the presenter of the One Love Breakfast, Patrick Hart.
Marvin, from my info, 27 years ago today, the murder of Stephen Lawrence. Hate crime, racial justice, the police, what in our city, how have things moved on? We've had the McPherson report, we've had right-wing media rubbishing that now and saying that report, you know, shouldn't have been listened to. Where does the land lie in 2020?
My blood begins to boil when you say that, the right-wing media.
Mine too.
Because it wasn't too long ago that I had quite a few posh media types descend on me when I dared to criticise the poor quality of a journalist.
Yeah.
This kind of self-righteousness of the profession is one that rings large, and a lack of self-awareness. So where it rings is, my thought was, I've always said that racism is about individual incidents.
Yeah.
The murder of Stephen Lawrence, you know, Anthony Walker, and the axe put in his head. But actually, you know, and that stuff is massively important. What McPherson got into is the institutional nature of it by definition. That every day, people with brown skin are born destined to die earlier, end up in mental health institutions or in the criminal justice system before they're likely to end up in higher education. And they're likely to be on the wrong end of social immobility. So this is the systemic robbery of life and opportunity that exists in the country, the systemic exclusion from positions of influence and power and leadership and decent pensions and decent housing. That hasn't changed, to be perfectly frank. We are where we are. We're still where we are. And the danger is that as we go through COVID and the costs of COVID, the health costs, but also the socioeconomic costs, fall disproportionately on the shoulders of BME people and working class people, that those inequalities will become entrenched. The right wing, whether they masquerade as journalists or however they masquerade, will not care about this. I think there was an article over the weekend, someone put it out to me in the FT saying, well, let's, you know, we just got to grow the economy again. Forget about gender pay gap and all these kind of, you know, PC things. Let's just get the economy moving. Well, that's not what we want. We need to rebuild differently. And some of the people asking for things to be different, I don't think they, I think they should really appreciate the scale of difference we're actually looking for. It's not just about getting people riding bicycles.
Yeah.
It's about a wholesale redistribution of wealth and power. And some of our leading, activists will probably have to look at their own parents' bank accounts as well when we think about that redistribution of wealth and power that the planet needs.
It's great, isn't it, to say what we all need from a position of privilege, Marvin. That's the thing, isn't it, sometimes. Many of our reporters and social commentators will say that.
Well, two very well-off people talking about redistribution of wealth there. But anyway, I mean, what do you make of the comments linking the attack on Adam Postans at a cabinet meeting, who is the Bristol Post local democracy reporter, with the sort of right-wing racist press and racism around the Stephen Lawrence case? Because I think I'm not sure that Adam would have taken very kindly as a local democracy reporter, or as any journalist would, to being compared to the people that were racists involved in the Stephen Lawrence case, racist white-wing journalists.
I think the problem is that Marvin Ackley completely undermines some serious arguments, one or two of which he actually makes himself, and lots of others, people better qualified, have made as well. Very serious injustices actually are devalued by him using, you know, his petty inability to actually deal with any criticism of himself or his institution. It's quite shocking, and I'm afraid that that condemns him to be hated by a lot of people because of that. And that doesn't mean to say that he hasn't got one or two useful things to say, but mixing those two things up is just quite shocking.
The criticism, Martin Summers, the criticism, I mean, you're a Labour Party member, you're in the same party as the mayor. This criticism of journalists generally, he's also saying that social media is one of the biggest problems, but of course, you know, this is where people go to express themselves. And I suppose, you know, I would say, well, if someone is being rude, you can always just block them. You know, you don't have to necessarily take what they're saying to heart and take it too seriously. But social media does play an important role. And of course, the mayor has actually spent quite a lot of money on researching social media. And he spends money also in, I keep seeing his posts popping up on my Facebook account, further and further up, almost every morning I switch it on, there's the mayor. He's obviously spending money on the social media, but he doesn't actually like the criticism that's coming through there.
Well, I think we've got to distinguish various aspects of this. I think the general position that there is institutional racism in our society hardly needs to be stated. It's so obvious that it's still there, and the mayor is perfectly within his rights to bring it up. To make the Bristol Post a whipping boy because they are the right-wing media, I think that's going a bit far. The Bristol Post, I wouldn't say it was right-wing, I wouldn't say it was left-wing, but if they're making criticisms of the mayor,
looking at who owns it,
not the right-wing media, that's the Bristol Post. The McPherson report.
Martin, let's point out that it's owned by Reach PLC, which is also the owner of the Mirror. And if anything, I mean, it certainly used to be owned by Northcliffe, which was the Daily Mail empire. I mean, I think if anything, the Reach PLC is to the left rather than to the right.
Well, but it's certainly not the Daily Mail. So in other words, that's a rather that criticism doesn't really hit the mark. Coming back to the McPherson report. The McPherson report brought in this whole idea of institutional racism, and it's quite interesting that a lot of the people who've been screaming and shouting in the Labour Party about institutional racism in relation to anti-Semitism have used the McPherson report's basic analysis to accuse the Labour Party of institutional anti-Semitism. Now, in actual fact, the McPherson report basically is... it's being manipulated there by a group which in actual fact in other circumstances wouldn't accept that there's institutional racism against people who are non-Jewish. Now, obviously we've had the recent report that was leaked about the people in the Labour Party at the top who were basically sabotaging our election campaign in 2017, which under First Past the Post, with a few more thousand votes, we might even have won. So there's a lot of dirt to be dug there.
But Martin, of course, before we ask Gary about
other things at the moment.
Before we ask Gary about that, I wonder if you think that I mean, this is the 2017 general election that this report is talking about. Absolutely shocking quotes from people who are clearly within the Labour Party machinery, apparatchiks and various sorts, who were trying to make sure that Jeremy Corbyn lost that election. I mean, we've had another election, didn't we, back in December last year, 2019. I wonder if you think that was all very well talking about that from 2 years or so ago, but it may have been that some of the same people and some of the same tactics were used last year.
Well, yes, of course. I mean, the same people were in place. Basically, the paid workers in the Labour Party are a bit of a mafia, and they've been a mafia for a long time, and they've got a definite view, which isn't necessarily the view of the membership, and that's been pretty clear all along. But this we've now got chapter and verse on it.
Martin, what about the MPs, though? Some people say that actually the MPs were also very anti-Corbyn.
Oh, there were certainly some were. And some, like Keir Starmer, at first were against Corbyn and then decided they were going to go with the flow. Others left the party and stood as, you know, stood for other parties and so on. The electoral system makes the Labour Party a rather unhappy man.
Well, I think that's totally unfair, because if you look at what Boris has done, getting rid of the Euro files from the Tory party, and what Nigel Farage has done in getting rid of the racists and the Toby Robinson supporters from UKIP and basically just sidestepping and starting a new party. It's really surely just about Corbyn not being a disciplinarian, not actually having the courage.
He's been accused of being too disciplinarian, Tony.
No, what I'm saying is it seems that he just hasn't had the courage to take on the right wing within his own party.
We've had a massive row about this, and you're not a member of the Labour Party. I am. We've had massive rows about it because, unfortunately, the electoral system forces us into one party, where in other parts of Europe, we wouldn't be in the same party. They could say what they think and we could say what we think, and okay, we could just go to the ballot box and find out who got the most support.
We can't do that
because the electoral system's rubbish.
What do you make of this thing in the Labour Party with all these full-time workers in the party actually working against Corbyn to stop him winning an election?
Well, I think a lot of them would regard themselves as doing their best to make the Labour Party electable. I think, as Martin says, the electoral system produces bad politics, not just within the Labour Party, but elsewhere. I mean, the Conservative Party now has gone, as you say, in a very clear direction, and for the moment has massive support. How long that will actually last when reality starts dawning is another matter.
Okay, well, that's it for this first hour. And what we'll do is we'll string on the second hour straight away afterwards. But we'll say for now, goodbye to Gary Hopkins, Lib Dem leader in the Lib Dem party on Bristol City Council, and also to Martin Summers. And we'll be back in a minute with a look at the international effects, even though we've talked a little bit about that. And it was interesting to hear Gary's take on some of the other countries and their approach to the virus. So we'll be back in a minute.
Belongs in the hands of people.
I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Dollar by the nickels worth. Banks going bust. We know things are bad, worse than bad.